And we should be finishing at 4:45, according to this programme, so I shall be quite brief in my introductions. But I'm going to introduce Rich Pulser very briefly. I think I'm right in saying that you've been involved in you're the third generation of five generations of woodcraft folk in your family. Four generations. And Rich is also an educator and a trade union leader and a scholar of woodcraft, as well as having family members who date right back to the beginning. We need to get a lapel mic on you.
Now can you hear me?
Yeah.
My contention is that the woodcraft folk in its early years had an approach which basically combined, an approach to social change, that combined a socialist goal with a eugenic strategy for achieving that goal. I think that that was first elaborated by Leslie Paul in late 25, early 26, during the time after the break from Kip O'Kift, when they were in the fellowship. I think it's encapsulated in the first educational program in 1926, Child in the Race. It was repeated later in 29, my memory serves me well, in the Folk Trail. Was officially abandoned, not until 1938-39, in the Republic of Children, but was implicitly abandoned with the training of pioneers in late 36, early 37. In other words, for a decade, the woodcraft folk had this combination of socialism and eugenics. What I want to do in this paper is to, first of all, look at exactly how that combination worked. And in particular, I want to build on the work of John Atfield, who, in a chapter in a book on In the Light of Knowledge about the Cooperative Society in Woolwich, devoted a chapter to the woodcraft folk in the interwar years. I want to build on that. But also want to identify how that combination was abandoned and how it was replaced by a different framework, a framework which I've characterised in other articles as being essentially an Owenite, as in Robert Owen, the utopian socialist, an Owenite view of education. Main sources are the sources here in the archive that I've been using over the past 6 months with the help of the archivists here. Okay, 1925, Paul says that eugenics and socialism, the relationship between them, is something like the relationship between the seed and the soil. The eugenist wants to perfect the race and is focusing on the seed. The socialist aims to change the environment, the soil. Both of these are necessary if you're going to get a good crop. However, the problem is, says Paul, the seed is degenerating because of the environment in the urban capitalist industrial centres. That the degeneration of the seed, therefore, is the problem facing humanity, or the race, as it was frequently called. He says, we cannot see that it is any use reaching a cooperative commonwealth if it is inhabited by a degenerating race. The solution was in tribal training or woodcraft. And the theoretical justification for this was Stanley Hall's theory of recapitulation. So this is how Leslie Paul described it. From its birth, a child epitomizes the mental developments that have taken place in man since he evolved on Earth. That is to say, the phases of child development correspond strongly to similar stages in the evolution of man. The child recapitulates in his desires, his actions and his thoughts, the struggles and questionings of early man. The educational idea that has grown up around this is called recapitulation theory. Now, Hall's adolescence, having looked at a lot of the secondary literature discussing it, not only is it generally accepted as having popularized the term adolescent as meaning a stage between childhood and full adulthood, a kind of hiatus in development, but also it had significance because adolescence was the period at which it was possible through the engineering of the process of recapitulating the evolution of man to bring about an evolutionary advance. That is to say, to quote Hall, adolescence is the only point of departure for the super anthropoid that man is to become. Now, I don't know whether Leslie Paul got this particular aspect of what Stanley Hall was advocating. Actually, in his Angry Young Man, he says that he read Hall's Adolescence as a schoolboy, found it generally beyond him, but he got the general idea because he was at that time accepting evolutionary philosophy, and that was fairly easy to assimilate. What is certainly the case is that if Leslie Paul was not thinking in terms of adolescence as a jumping off point for a further evolutionary advance, he was certainly thinking of it, as did Seton in his books, certainly thinking of it as a means of countering the degeneration that was occurring in the urban environment. Now, he didn't put forward the use of all the little prescriptions, many of them contradictory, that adolescence contains about how to enable children to fully go through that recapitulation process. He takes a more broad brush approach in line with his comments on what he absorbed of adolescence. Although it may seem true that the child does pass through these processes, we have no means of ascertaining their duration or their power. The child may go through all the developments of the Stone Age man in a few hours, or alternatively, she may remain for years in the gang or tribal stage. So that beyond recognition of the general principle, we cannot use this as a definite educational method for spare time training. Our use of the principle must be as follows, that by taking children out of the city into the open, by letting them educate to themselves in the natural environment, we enable them instinctively to express the stage through which they are passing. Beyond that, recapitulation is out of our hands. Now, all I've said so far does not fully explain, in my view, how Leslie Paul saw the combination of a socialist aim and a eugenic strategy. Whereas the eugenics, where Paul is essentially saying we have to remove young people into the outdoors environment in order to combat the effects, the degenerative effects of the urban environment. He's still essentially utilizing the environment rather than, where the emphasis of eugenics was, on the breeding, the seed, in terms of bringing about an evolutionary, an advantageous evolutionary progress. Well, I think the answer to it is to see the way in which eugenics could either be seen as what they call negative eugenics or positive eugenics. Negative eugenics emphasized preventing the breeding of the unfit, or discouraging if not preventing. Positive eugenics emphasized the breeding of the fit. Before the First World War, the Eugenics Society emphasized the breeding of the middle classes because their birth rate was falling, and so measures to encourage the middle classes to have more children. The stopping of the breeding of the unfit placed emphasis on things like voluntary or forced sterilization of the mentally ill, a category that could include a whole series of characteristics. Paul essentially said, Leslie Paul said, he had a positive approach to each. That is, we set a standard of mental and physical health below which it is unlikely that any of us will marry. That is, woodcrafters will marry. This standard, based on education, is of course the keynote of eugenics. This is directly comes from Kibbo Kift and John Hargrave. The instinct for health and strength in these men and women, that's those who have gone through woodcraft methods, will lead them to select partners for life from among those who have had much the same training. And the result of such a combination will naturally produce children of a finer mental and physical capacity than was otherwise possible. In this way, natural eugenics will develop. Instinct will lead them to select the finest in mind and body, and thus, in time, a bloodline or caste of hardihood will evolve. That essentially was the view of Leslie Paul as he came out of Kibbo Kif and as he formulated the first policies for the woodcraft folk. And it appears in later versions in the Folk Trail in 1929. Degeneracy spreads until the race finds itself without the vitality to combat it. A sane eugenical mode of living and a keener appreciation of the necessity for simple living and hard thinking are necessary preliminaries in any attempt to combat it. And even if any crusade against unfitness on a national scale is not possible, it is urgent that the folk attempt, and I emphasise, to build a new caste of supple-bodied and vigorous-minded people who shall be worthy of the future. This eugenic strategy influenced many aspects of the woodcraft folk's early policy, including its educational policy. Give one example, international contacts. Young leaders of the folk looked to the youth organisations, not of the workers' parties on the continent, but towards the Van der Vogel in Germany. They perceived the Van der Vogel as an autonomous movement of youth, rather than as the Scouts were, a movement of young people run by adults. In an article in the Herald in 1930, they look back on the Van der Vogel and comment, "This is not the romanticism of adolescence, but a fighting creed by which a new society was one day to rise like a phoenix from the ruins of the old. The youth movement was the nucleus of a new race, and it was a fundamental honesty and an intimate association with nature upon which it was building." In fact, in the early years, to some extent, the woodcraft folk was less an educational organisation for young people and more a movement of young people. As Leslie Paul points out, most of the original leaders of the folk were 20 or younger at the time it was formed. The folk described itself as the first youth movement within cooperative spheres to give coherent and conscious expression to the ideals and philosophy of young people. So whilst they allied themselves with the labour movements of the day, trade unions, cooperatives, the Labour Party, they also held themselves to be superior to it. It's true that during the general strike of 1926, the folk turned out, you read Angry Young Man, Leslie Paul's experience of the Council of Action in Lewisham. Other members of the folk in London turned out to help with strike bulletins, strike committees and so on. But the defeat of the strike, for them, was perceived as a consequence of the inadequacy of the working class movement. Paul's response was, as he puts it in his looking back in his autobiography, a new and better human material was needed. What could be done with a human wreckage which capitalism had left lying about? Parodying an aphorism of Lloyd George, I said, and this became our slogan for a time, you can't get A1 socialism from C3 people. Now, there's a contradiction here. On the one hand, the folk's advancing eugenic strategy based on the inadequacy of the working class, viewing itself as the youthful embodiment of everything that the labour movement lacked. On the other hand, it was appealing to the labour movement and the cooperative movement in particular to provide the funding and publicity so that it could build itself. How could you combine the two? Well, it's important to understand that eugenics was not seen in the 1920s as we see it today in the aftermath of the Nazi experience and the scholarship that has gone into unmasking scientific racism. Rather, within the working class movement, there were many people who would support eugenics, who saw eugenics as compatible with socialism. This was particularly the case amongst intellectuals who associated themselves with the working class movement in larger numbers after the First World War and played a much greater role inside the Labour Party. Whilst critical of mainstream economics for its underestimating the role of the environment in shaping someone's physical and mental character, they accepted that inheritance also played a role. So whilst advocating reforms that would minimise the negative effects of the environment, they shared the eugenist fear of degeneration, and they were prepared to countenance eugenic measures to discourage or prevent the breeding of degenerates. And the folk shared this fear of degenerates in its early years. I want to quote from the course of instruction developed between 28 and 30, which outlines the folks' attitude towards recruitment of children. Backward, mentally deficient and unfit children should not be enrolled in the group. They need special attention and organisation you cannot afford. Well, Mom might agree on practical grounds on that. Please note that for the health of the children who are whole, they should never be included in a group, no matter what the personal plea. Experience shows that viciousness and sexual irresponsibility goes hand in hand with mental deficiency and sometimes venereal disease as well. You cannot take too many precautions to protect children from association with people who are irresponsible or abnormal in any way. Some safeguarding policy, eh? The folks' combination of eugenics and socialism actually meant it could emphasise either aspect of their approach according to the audience, and it could be understood by members and its audience in different ways. So, for example, camping and hiking in the countryside, away from the degenerating influence of the town, provided an environment in which children could naturally recapitulate the instinct of stages of man's evolution, grow strong in mind and body, and marry the appropriate person. Simultaneously, it removed the commercialised culture of the town and capitalism and the influences of church and school. I could go on about the way one aspect could be interpreted in another way. What I want to do, however, because I realise I've gone over time, thank you, is to focus on how this period came to an end. John Atfield was the first to suggest that it was the rise of fascism in Germany that resulted in the folk abandoning its attempts to combine socialism and eugenics. I want to build on that explanation, but I find his argument oversimplified. Essentially, the argument is this, that as the Nazi policy, justified on the basis of a eugenic view, became clear to people like Leslie Paul, and they saw the way in which that leaders of the youth movement in Germany, as well as former leaders of Kibo Kift in the UK, were bending to that political stance, that he decided to break firmly with eugenics and to write The Training of Pioneers, the new manual for the woodcraft folk. The problem with that explanation is I think it focuses too much on Leslie Paul as an individual. Now, we heard this morning, and quite rightly, Leslie Paul was a key figure in the woodcraft folk, ideologically, politically, educationally. And there's no doubt that he had a tremendous influence. But it seems to me unlikely that his influence could have been carried through to change the direction of the woodcraft folk without at least some discussion of Nazi eugenic policies, and in particular some discussion about the implications of that in terms of the folk's own policy at the time. And more to the point, how in an organisation that prided itself as democratic could the woodcraft folk adapt to a new educational theorisation of its practice without that internal debate occurring? And yet in the archives there's very little evidence of such discussion. I think that there were two things that impacted on the woodcraft folk as a result of the Nazis coming to power. The first was a shift from identifying with youth movements in general, and particularly with the Van der Vogel in Germany, to attempting to forge links with socialist organisations for youth and children on the continent. This began when Leslie Paul visited Red Vienna in 1930, when the Austrian Red Falcons came to the 33 International Camp, and when the bombardment of Vienna took place and the crushing of Red Vienna, the Social Democratic-led government, the folk was receiving letters from young people and leaders in the Falcon movement explaining their plight. It was that, even more so than the defeat in Germany the previous year, which led the folk to build those contacts and to orientate more and more towards the Socialist Educational International. Secondly, it led to the folk beginning to question their lack of involvement with the organisation of anti-fascist and anti-war activity. Indeed, it's the cult issue comes up here. Because for Leslie Paul, this required a shift outwards to build a youth movement. Because of the way I've wasted my time here, I can't go into the details of the various stages and failures to build a youth movement. Sufficient to say, by 37, this move towards building a youth movement was no longer what the leadership decided was possible. They decided, primarily because of the political problems involved in organising a youth movement, what line do you take on the Popular Front? What line do you take on the United Front? What line do you take on Abyssinia? What do you say in relation to X, Y, Spain in particular by 36? Because of all those problems of pacifism, the folk retreated from building a youth movement into being a children's organisation. Now, in the process of swinging outwards, the old evolutionary, over two, three generations, we will bring about a change in the working class movement, eugenic approach, ceased to have the relevance, the bite that it did for weak craft members. Now it became, how do you fight fascism? How do you organise against war? This was the urgency that you find in all the documents of the folk at that time. But having moved out and been, not defeated, but finding the difficulties of that and wanting to pass the baton back to other organisations to play that role, it doesn't move back to its old recapitulation theory. It is engaged in a new debate. And that new debate, I'll have to finish here, was the Socialist Education International. And if you look at the helper from the end of 1935 through 36 and into 37, at the debate between Kurt Lowenstein on the one hand, Woodcraft leaders on the other hand, you will see how the folk arrived at essentially a utopian socialist view of its educational policy.
Amazing, thank you. Beautifully timed as well. So thank you very much, Rich. And we'll be reflecting on your presentation and the very controversial quotations that you provided us with, I'm sure, in the discussion time after Andy Flynn's paper.